She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy, darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, hopefully a very fun and informative place where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And I always do a shout out to one of our amazing partners that helps make this show and all of the other things that are going on in Mrs. Green's World happen. And for this show, it's the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. And I do have to mention that the United States Composting Council has deemed Tank's Green Stuff the 2016 Composter of the Year. They make an incredible organic compost that is getting recognition all over the country, obviously, since United States Composting Council gave them Composter of the Year. I'm so proud of my relationship with them. And to find out more about them, please visit thefairfaxcompanies.com. And hopefully that compost will be coming to a store near you before you know it. So before we get on with the show and to our very inspiring guest, I would like to take a minute. I have never done this in 10 years, but I'd like to dedicate this show to my dear friend Rafe Sagarin, and I can feel myself getting a little choked up. He was the author of Learning from the Octopus. We had him on the show numerous times. He was a professor at the University of Arizona and was tragically killed way too soon in Tucson, Arizona, on May 25th, 2015, and I can say this without a doubt, his legacy lives on in the hearts of many, and I am sure this is a show Rafe would like to know all about. So let's get on with it. I am so excited about this show because I'm going to be talking to a soulmate. Basically, really, she's a person that has done everything I have been too afraid to do. So it's really, it's not a soulmate in that regard, but her name is Cy Montgomery. She's the author of many books, but we're going to be talking particularly about one of them, The Soul of an Octopus. She's a naturalist, an author, a scriptwriter for children's as well as adults. She is the author of more than 20 books, including The Soul of an Octopus. I'm rushing. I got to calm down here. A surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness, which was a finalist for the 2015 National Book Award for Nonfiction and a New York Times bestseller. And having written a book, to know that I'm talking to someone that is nominated for a finalist for the National Book Award, it's a big deal because people write lots of books, but very few of them get that nomination. Her most popular book, however, is The Good, Good Pig, the best-selling memoir of her life with her pig. And I am going to talk about that, too. So, Cy, that was a long introduction, and I am calming down because I am so excited.
So am I, Gina. I am so delighted to be on the show.
We're going to have fun, and I cannot wait for you to share things. And I always like to start, when I started reading about your life, I always go to a place of, you know, I think you have done in your lifetime what would take a minimum of three people to experience. I was figuring out, okay, so she did this and she did that. Outrageously courageous explorer involving encounters with gorillas, angry gorillas, being bitten by bats. This is not the average or over or normal life experience that I come across every day. So what started it? It really is incredibly courageous. That's the word that kept coming up for me. What were some of the seeds that were planted when you were little or when you were developing that said, I can do this?
Well, you're so lovely to call me courageous, Gina. But
you are courageous. I am the chicken. Well, I am the weenie of the world.
No, I'm not getting bitten by a bat. Look what you've done. And on all of us who need to protect this sweet green earth have to be courageous. So it's good to talk about
it. It's a different kind of courage. You're right.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Well, my father was a survivor of the Bataan Death March. He was a general in the Army.
Wow.
Member of the Joint Chiefs. He is buried in Section 1 of Arlington National Cemetery next to General Wainwright. And he was my hero. He was my model of courage. And my mother, who had grown up poor in a tiny Arkansas town that last time I visited had a population of 331, managed to go to college, be valedictorian of her class, learn to fly a plane.
No way! No wonder you're courageous. You had good genes, kiddo.
Oh man! Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I was an only child. I never questioned that if it could be done by a person, it could be done by me.
Unreal. Unreal. And your parents obviously supported that.
Well, you know, it's hard. I think it was hard for them having one child. And so, of course, like many parents, I think it was tempting to want your one child to be just like them. And I mean, I wanted to be like them in many ways, but I did not want to go into the Army. I didn't want other people telling me what to do.
Shocking.
And my father loved animals, and my mother loved some animals, but she was deathly afraid of snakes and spiders and things like that. She used to be a hunter. She used to hunt squirrels and eat them, for example.
That's unreal for me. It is.
A lot of little bones.
Right. A lot of little bones.
So they would have preferred I have a different life than I did. And in Good Pig, which is the closest thing I'll ever come to a memoir, I talk a little bit about my family and how my life differed from what they wanted, and like many families, there was some strife in ours. But I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to write about animals, and that there was tremendous power in writing about animals. And I learned this as I was learning to read. My father, my hero, was always reading the New York Times in the morning, and I wanted to know what he was reading. Well, I was born in 1958, and so I was beginning to read in the 60s. Well, what was in the newspapers in the 60s about animals, which, of course, my dad knew was what I would want to hear? Well, it was all about pollution and deforestation and human overpopulation, and my dad would help me read these stories. And I was horrified as a little kid, horrified. The animals that I loved, our national symbol, the bald eagle, was about to go extinct. You know, whales, who I loved, were threatened with extinction. Elephants were being murdered for their teeth, and so on. And I saw these courageous journalists writing these stories and making people care. And up to then, you know, remember, I'm like in first grade, but up to then,
what
I thought,
heavy duty, you know, I mean, it's true. When you're at that age, you have the intellectual intelligence, perhaps, but the emotional intelligence piece, it's a heavy burden. And I remember being scared about things like that. What does that mean if the bald eagle? And I'm older than you are, but it was like the bald eagle might go extinct. And at that time, I'm from New Jersey, you could literally walk across the Hudson River. It was so polluted. And I'm barely kidding. I mean, we were killed.
Oh, I know. That I lived in New Jersey also. And in fact, I chose to work in New Jersey. It was my number one spot. I wanted to work in New Jersey as a newspaper reporter because it had a lot of pollution issues. It had more scientists and engineers per capita than any other state, and a lot of like good stuff to write about. So it's you know, it was terrific. But you know, it's so important, I think, that we talk about kids and the power that children have. As a kid, I made this life choice. I made several of my life choices that I followed as a child. And, of course, nobody believed me back then. But children are, you know, often we say, oh, they're the leaders of tomorrow. But they are the leaders of today as well.
Yes,
which is
and we
why
better listen.
Half my books are for kids.
Yes, yes. Amazing
so I
books.
I write for all ages. You know, you never know who you're going to reach. But kids have a tremendous amount of power. And I'm looking at what some kids are doing right now, and it's amazing. I mean, just one example, there's this kid, I think he might be 12. He's his alter ego, or his other name is the microactivist. And
I'm writing it down. It sounds like a show guest.
Go on YouTube and see some of the episodes. That he's a scuba diver, and he loves the sea, and his job is to save the sea, and he does so with these fantastically high-quality little films that he does. And I had the privilege of being part of one of his little films on octopus, but they knock your socks off. And that's just one example of one kid. And I think at times like this, when you and I and many of your listeners may be feeling not very empowered.
We don't have to tiptoe around it. Not as hopeful, given our current...
Yeah, not so hopeful.
Let's be
honest. Maybe like reaching for the cyanide tab.
Yeah.
But, at times like this, it's great to remember that even people who cannot vote and do not drive and don't have any money, children have enormous power.
We have to remember. We have to remember. It's not just good.
We have to give them the tools that they need.
We do.
And what I do is write these books to put in their hands. So, a bunch of my books are for kids, a bunch of my books are for adults. Most of my adult readers don't know that I write for children. Most of my kid readers don't know that I write for adults.
But, when I was doing the research about you, and hopefully I did a lot of really good digging and getting the depth and breadth of your contribution to the planet, I want to read some of the kids' books. My husband and I are blessed to have these two amazing grandchildren, and we go to a lot of the animated films, and they're supposed to be
aren't they great?
Kids' movies. Well, we have gone, we don't want to go to Disneyland as adults without kids, but we do go to kids' movies, ostensibly kids' movies that are just delightful and fun and great messaging. So I understand that. And I can't go on in the interview without mentioning these two amazing miracle workers named Carter and Olivia Reese, who I've had on the show at least three times. And they started a nonprofit when they were like 7 and 9 called One More Generation.
Wow.
And they've gotten all kinds of awards, and they're getting more awards. And they started this so that we can keep any species from going extinct for at least one more generation. So you're right about kids. And they're amazing. So, let's hear it for the kids.
Well, my husband and I just watched Finding Dory, which of course has a great octopus, Hank, in it. And having spent years, in the company of octopuses, befriending octopuses, personally knowing octopuses who look up in my face and recognize me, and there's now one named after me at the New England Aquarium who's my friend.
We so have to talk about
this, I'm watching Hank on this, and it's so octopus-like. He's really very octopus-like.
They knew their octopus.
I love these things. They did. They really did. I mean, these things, these animals are just more like science fiction aliens than anything you could make up. They can taste with all of their skin. They can pour their boneless bodies through tiny little openings. They can change color and shape. They have a beak like a parrot and venom like a snake and ink like an old-fashioned pen. you just cannot believe this. Their mouths are in their armpits. And yet, one of these animals can look you in the face and recognize your face uniquely among the other crowd. We know this not just from my experience, but from scientific experiments. We know they recognize people even when they're identically dressed, even when they are not tasting those people, but when they're just looking up through the water at these people. And they like some people and they don't like others. And I was lucky enough to get to know, for the book, 4 octopuses very, very well. And there's another now, Cy, who I know very well at the New England Aquarium. And people thought I was crazy to write a book titled The Soul of an Octopus. How can a mollusk, a marine invertebrate, even have a soul?
If reading anything about you and what you wrote, and I do want to read a quote, because, there were other questions I wanted to ask you, but you and I knew this was going to be whatever comes up is going to come up. And that's the ease and grace part of it. But the quote just got me. And it said, "True immersion journalism in pursuit of the wild, solitary, predatory octopus, popular naturalist Cy Montgomery has practiced true immersion journalism. Oh, I love that. From New England aquarium tanks to the reefs of French Polynesia and the Gulf of Mexico, here's what got me. She has befriended octopuses with strikingly different personalities, gentle Athena, assertive Octavia, curious Callie, and joyful Karma. Each creature shows her cleverness in a myriad of ways, escaping enclosures like an orangutan, jetting water to bounce balls, and endlessly tricking companions with multiple sleights of hand to get food. And I'm reading that, I'm like, are you kidding me right now? This is about an octopus. And my brain started going on overload with questions, the first of which is, what started you on your path to studying the octopus? How did that journey begin with a single step?
Boy, well, at that point, I'd written maybe 15 books that had already been published, and almost all of them were terrestrial, almost all of them were about mammals. I'd written a book for kids in the Scientists in the Field series that I founded with photographer Nick Bishop on tarantulas, but that was the only invertebrate that I'd written about. And by the way, tarantulas can live to 30 years, and they know stuff too.
Oh my gosh.
But anyway, and I'd also written Journey of the Pink Dolphin, a book for adults, in which I'd gotten to know some of the pink dolphins that live in the Amazon. But
I saw pink dolphins in the Amazon, and it was like, that's one of my most outstanding experiences when I saw that. It's like, it was, you can't translate that to anybody when you see them swimming beside your boat. And we had a photographer with us from National Geographic, and he said, oh, wow. I've been doing this for 15 years, and I have never seen it. They were like, you know, it was a bunch of women who were, we fashion ourselves as modern day priestesses, and it was a very spiritual trip for us. And wow. It was magic. I can't even. And I'm
they
on the board.
They are like magic.
They are.
And then, I mean, they call them encantados because they say they are enchanted.
I so believe it. And that's the name of one of your books. And we have to, like, help each other remember, because another one you wrote that's going to jump out at me, you wrote the book about Temple Grandin. And I didn't know that. And that was a oh my God, what a movie. So we have to go back to Soul of an Octopus. I don't want to digress that badly.
Yeah, sorry. Well,
with my whirling dervish brain.
When you talk to someone you really like.
Yes,
and
it's so
lovely
true.
To have all these listeners around us as part of the conversation, but they might be having trouble following us. But anyway,
exactly.
All of these other books that I'd written, none of them really looked at the kind of animal that dominates the Earth. Most animals on this planet live in the ocean, and they are invertebrates. And I had known none of them. And here I was into, you know, my 50s as a naturalist. And I felt, you know, now it is time that I get to know a marine invertebrate.
Wow.
And I felt, you know, all of my books really are love stories to these animals and trying to get to know them as individuals. This is how we love. We get to know individuals, and that is how, you know, that great tsunami of love begins to swell for everyone in that group. But it starts with one individual, and then more and more and more. So what I decided to do was to make an octopus my friend. And that sounds crazy to some people. You know, how can you make an octopus your friend?
It's
how,
like,
can
what?
A mollusk, you know,
yes.
Who else is a mollusk? Clams. They don't even have brains. You know, how can you be friends with somebody that different? But even though we're separated by 500 million years of evolution from octopuses, even though the last time we shared a common ancestor, it was before there were any limbs, it was before there were any eyes, it was before there were any land plants, it was when everyone was a tube. That's the last time we shared an ancestor, and yet you can be friends with an octopus.
And the connection.
Octopuses recognize us. They know who we are, and we can begin to know who they are. And to me, this just opens an entire new world on our sweet green earth. And in fact, this is what caused me to finally learn to scuba dive, which I'd never done before.
I haven't done it either, but you're now my new role model, so I know it's coming up. I mean, I'm serious. It's like, if she can do that, I can do a little bit. Scuba diving is huge. We are at our first break, which makes me very sad. Everybody.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Stay here with us. We are going to dive into the soul of an octopus more with Cy Montgomery as soon as we get back. Stay here with us.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for being with us, because where would we be without our great listeners? It makes me so excited when someone tells me they've listened to this show or that show. So join, and wait till they listen to this show. Joining us for this hour is Cy Montgomery, my new hero. I am so not kidding. And I have to tell you a little bit more about Cy. To research books, films, and articles, and of course I took this from one of the websites I visited, Cy Montgomery, ready everybody, has been chased by an angry silverback gorilla in Zaire and bitten by a vampire bat in Costa Rica. Worked in a pit, this is the killer for me, crawling with 18,000 snakes in Manitoba, not ever going to go on my bucket list, and handled a wild tarantula on French Guiana, also not on my bucket list, in French Guiana. She has been deftly undressed by an orangutan in Borneo, got to hear that story, hunted by a tiger in India, and swum with piranhas, electric eels, and dolphins in the Amazon. And, OPS, she is also the author of a bazillion books, the latest being the best-selling book, The Soul of an Octopus, a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness. Cy, can you tell I'm excited to have you as a guest on Mrs. Green's World Show? Is it coming through okay?
Boy, well, I'm just as excited to be on your show.
No, it seems like, oh, we have a whole hour, and I'm thinking, male, maybe like 3 hours. I think we should start the Cy Montgomery Show, and we'll just take a chapter of each book. But anyway, talk about how do you get to be friends with an octopus. Bring us into the soul of that experience.
Well, when I met my first octopus, her name was Athena, named after the goddess of war and wisdom. I went behind the scenes. I was writing a story for the magazine Orion, and the aquarist at the New England Aquarium opened up the lid to the tank. You have to have a lid on that tank or the octopus will get out. He opens up the lid, and this beautiful, huge creature with an arm span of at least 8 or 9 feet, with a what looks like a head the size of a melon, actually it's the head and the mantle, which is the body, looks me in the eye. This silvery eye swivels in its socket and locks onto my face, and she slides over to me from her lair, and then her arms come boiling up out of the water. And so I rolled up my sleeves and I took off my watch and I plunged my hands and arms into the freezing cold 47-degree water and start stroking her. And instantly, I'm covered with these silvery discs, her suckers, which are tasting me at the same time that they're touching me. And I realize not everyone might have liked this, but I was thrilled because here is this alien creature, so different from us. They just seem like space aliens. But someone who was just as curious about me and as eager to meet me as I was eager to meet her. And I began to stroke her head. And I noticed at first she was bright red with excitement, which can show that they're happy or can show that they're irritated. It's just excitement, just like we might turn
so
red.
So change
excitement.
Colors? Like literally
oh,
change
yeah.
colors?
They can change color and shape. They can grow spots on themselves. They can change the texture of their their skin, they can fold themselves up and pour themselves like water through tiny openings. They're just, you know, they have these superpowers that a person can only dream of.
I cannot believe it. I cannot believe it. Yeah.
And yet you can be friends with someone like this.
Most people don't know that. Let's be honest. They have no idea the complexity of this intelligent, complex, and you know, spirited. They have spirit creature. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. They have a sense of humor. They have different senses of humor. One of the octopuses who I got to know, her name was Octavia, I came to interact with her very early in our relationship. I'd only been with her maybe two or three times. And I went with a radio crew. We were doing a segment on octopus intelligence. And I think six of us were present. We were petting her. We were feeding her. Three of us had our hands in the tank, but six of us were looking at her. And we went to feed her another fish, and we looked, and the bucket of fish was gone. She had stolen the bucket of fish out from under our six eyes. She had outwitted six human beings.
Six smart human beings, I would assume.
Well, one would assume. I mean, they are so great. And what's terrific about the film, the animated film Finding Dory that we were talking about a little earlier, was Hank the Octopus. I've seen everything Hank does except talk. I've seen an octopus do. They can become completely invisible against any background. They can look like a completely other thing. They don't just camouflage to look like their background. If they want to, certain octopuses can look like a poisonous, spiny sea fish, or they can look like a poisonous sea snake, or they can look like a rock, or they can look like a passing cloud. I mean, they have to imagine the minds of the creatures they're trying to fool in order to do these camouflage
things.
It's
just high-level intelligence. It really is.
Totally.
I mean, it is.
You know, play. Play is considered an aspect, an attribute of a higher mind.
Right.
Octopuses definitely play. And we know they play because they like to play with the same toys we give our children.
Jeez.
They love to play with Mr. Potato Head. They love to play with Legos.
I want to see this movie.
And ears.
Seriously.
They're just the most amazing critters. And their personalities are so distinctive. You can see this in the names that they are given. At the Seattle Aquarium, where I visited several times, a terrific aquarium also, they had one octopus that they named Leisure Suit Larry because his arms were all over you. And another one was so shy they called her Emily Dickinson because she just hid behind the filter.
So we have to, like, tying it back for a minute, are some of the things that you just articulated, is that why the scientific community is not laughing about this and saying, yeah, she's wackadoodle and there's no such thing as an octopus with a soul? What are they looking at? Because there is respect. The scientific community finally accepted the intelligence of dogs and birds and other, and chimpanzees, which they could have just asked a lot of other people without having to do the research.
Right, like Jane Goodall.
Yeah, Jane Goodall. Dr. Jane would have told them exactly how smart they are. But why, you know, and I go back to Rafe, when he was on the show and I read his book, there he had contracts with the Secret Service. I mean, there were things that the intelligence community wanted to learn from the octopus. What? I mean, what?
Well, among other things, I mean, they're a fantastic model for soft robots.
Got it.
You know, if you want to build a soft robot that's unconstrained by joints.
Okay.
Here you got one.
Okay.
And here's an octopus who, you know, this animal can multitask like nobody's business. And why? Because 3/5 of their neurons are not located in their brain, but in their arms.
Oh, my God, sensory.
You can sever an octopus's arm, as happens in the wild. You know, someone comes along and bites off an arm. That arm can continue to do stuff, including hunt. Now, the arm isn't going to live because it's now disconnected from the octopus's three hearts, for example, and all of the digestive organs and everything like that. So that arm is not in very good shape. However, the octopus can then regrow that arm. There's another thing that would be awfully nice if we could do. to regrow our limbs.
It would be really nice.
So, you know, they can do all this great stuff.
Yes.
And they can do it within their lifespan, which is only 3 to 5 years for a giant Pacific octopus.
You're kidding. Is that, that's it?
They grow from a little tiny paralarvae the size of a grain of rice to up to 100 pounds in 3 to 5 years.
Wow.
They're one of the fastest growing organisms on the planet.
Right. Oh my gosh. Unbelievable. When you were, like, when you were deep into this, the immersion journalism, which I absolutely love.
It's a great quote, and I didn't say it.
No, it is.
Someone and my publisher did.
Very, 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 like, it jumps out, immersion journalism. What did you, like, what were some of the biggest surprises? Like, when you say spirited creature, what's an example that you saw that says, oh my goodness, I can't believe this? I mean, maybe stealing the fish, the bucket of fish, that's pretty funny.
Oh, yeah, certainly. That was quite, that was
that's
quite
a good
spirited.
Example. And how smart that they were to do that.
And I also could see how, you know, several octopuses I've known will do this. They can aim water out of their funnel or jet, which is how they jet through the sea. They don't just use it to move, though. They can squirt it at things that upset them, that annoy them, or that they want to play with. And I have seen them squirt people right in the face, blasting them with freezing cold salt water. And one octopus who I knew did this to a young man, super guy. His name was Danny. He had pervasive developmental disorder, and his twin sister worked as a volunteer at the aquarium. It was their birthday, and as a surprise, she brought him behind the scenes.
Wow.
Well, Danny was fascinated by octopuses, but had also seen all these scary things about them. So while he wanted to touch the octopus, her name was Kali, he was also afraid, so he was shaking. And every time he would touch Kali, she would withdraw. Well, finally, she got sick of that and just blasted him in the face with cold water. And he thought that was hilarious. And from that moment on, they were fast friends.
Oh, my gosh. What a beautiful story.
She was aware.
So many levels. Oh.
You know, she was aware that he was nervous. She was aware of that he was different from everybody else. But I think she also kind of felt like, you know, let me play with this guy. Let me just blast it with some water. And I don't know that she predicted that that would change his behavior, but it did change his behavior. And it was just what he needed to be friends with this beautiful young animal who was extremely friendly.
Communication. I mean, that level of communication, it's unbelievable. And there's so much impactful in that story that you just told us, and connection on so many levels. It's like, go a little bit deeper and think of what exactly was happening in that transaction. I mean, it's pretty touching and profound to me.
Oh, you know what I wish is that we could read their color changes, because they're definitely signaling to other creatures with these color changes. Sometimes they're signaling purposely false information. Oh, look, I'm a poisonous flatfish, or right. Wait, I'm really a handful of scary snakes, or I'm not an octopus at all. I'm a cloud. I'm this, I'm that. But they also do signal to other octopuses, and we're not sure what they're saying. There's a place called Octopolis, and it's off the coast of Australia. And my friend, who's written a wonderful book, his name is Peter Godfrey Smith. His book is called Other Minds. He has traveled there with a friend who's also a diver and documented the gloomy octopus. He's not gloomy at all. He's actually a cheerful octopus. He has very soulful eyes, so they call it the gloomy octopus, Octopus tetricus. They live in large groups, and he has filmed, along with another friend of mine who you'll find in my book, David Scheel, that they will signal each other, hey, I'm in this lair, don't you come here, I'm a big octopus. And the other one, to whom the first is signaling, will literally turn white as a sheet, like Casper the Friendly Ghost, and melt away. The one who is doing the signaling of I'm a big bad octopus, he looks in the film exactly like Darth Vader.
Oh,
I mean, he turns black, he stands up tall, he looks like Darth Vader's helmet and cloak. And even a foolish human can tell, here is an octopus who's trying to impress you with how strong and deadly they can be.
Brave and mean.
But, you know, black and white, those are only two of the colors that they can they can become, and they can make themselves striped, they can make themselves spot, they can do iridescence, they can do all kinds of things. What are they saying?
And why are they doing it? I know, it's you're the immersion journalist. You should know the answer to that.
Well, I think their language, you know, if we're going to call it a language, their way of communicating with their skin is so complex.
Yes.
That we need a lot more time and we need a lot more study. And we better take care of our seas if we want to have that opportunity. Because if we continue polluting and warming our seas and killing our reefs at the rate that we're going, we're going to lose these animals and most of life on our planet.
Many more. And that was, you know, part of the discussion that I want to have and that we have a little bit more time to go into for sure, the impact of climate change and global warming on these precious critters. I mean, the seas to me right now, people don't get it. You get it. I get it. They're taking the biggest hit right now. Most of the species that are disappearing, it's what lies beneath. We don't see them. It's not like an elephant being slaughtered in Africa. They're just disappearing. I mean, I had a guest on recently that said by the year 2020, 50% of all species on Earth will have disappeared. And that is that is not even alarming to me anymore. I mean, it's alarming in that it's horrible, but it wasn't surprising. That's a better word.
Right, I know.
It's like, yeah.
Given our sheer population size, given all the horrible chemicals that we're releasing into the air, water, and soil, given our pathological appetite to eat every kind of flesh that exists in this in the world, I guess it should not be surprising, but it sure
but it
is
still
upsetting.
Is. I mean,
but we have the power to not do it. I mean, or else you would not be on the air, and I would not be writing books, and we would not have this fantastic audience of thinking, feeling, active people who are going to change that.
You know,
hopefully in our lifetime. But if not, we've got generations coming after.
We are at such risk. And the reason I was laughing is because I remembered one of the things I read about you. As I'm envisioning you in many of these scenarios where I think someone described you as part Indiana Jones and part Emily Dickinson. And isn't that just the best? It's like kind of the quintessence. It's like, yeah, you want to know what she's like? Here she is, poet, gentle spirit, and then Indiana Jones, who everything.
Yeah, you know who did that? It was a Boston Globe columnist at the time, now national best-selling author Vicki Constantine Croak, who wrote most recently the huge hit of a book, Elephant Company. And she's one of us for sure.
She's one of us. Sounds like another good fun interview.
Yeah, she would be. She would be, that's for sure.
I want to know about, I mean, you have obviously had what I would call a love story with this amazing critter. It's in a beautiful, beautiful way. What about their love story? I mean, is there any sense of showing emotion towards other octopus? You know what I mean? How does that all come about?
Well, interestingly, I spent, for the research of this book, one Valentine's Day flying across the country far away from my husband watching octopuses have sex.
And, of course you did.
Oh my gosh. The Seattle Aquarium has the octopus blind date every year on February 14th.
Oh, stop it.
And no, they release into each other's tank a male and female adult giant Pacific octopus, and it's a fraught occasion because sometimes it's literally a dinner date.
Oh,
cannibalism is not unknown in this species. And one year it actually did happen, which kind of ruined the whole thing. But happily, it did not happen in front of the public because tons of school children come to this thing.
Oh my gosh, that would be a really bad date.
Oh. I know, oh my gosh.
It would be a really bad date.
The date that I saw was tremendously moving and tremendously sexy. And as I was describing it to a friend of mine. We're on a commuter train from Boston to New York, and I'm going, and yes, he flew into her arms, and they flushed red with excitement, and soon They were covered with each other's suckers and sliding beside, and, you know, soon I noticed that no one in the car that
was
we were in was talking. Yes.
Really?
So, I mean, it was very sexy. I mean, lots of lube when you're both covered with slime, and lots of sensation when there are six hearts beating as one, because each octopus has three. And, you know, 200 suckers that can taste as well as feel on each of their eight arms. There's a lot of sensation going on here.
Sex and the Octopus, the next book. Hold on, everybody. We're going to be back in about 30 seconds to hear more from Cy Montgomery, and I, for one, cannot wait.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of that world. Joining us for this hour is Cy Montgomery, and I just can't say enough. She is a naturalist, author, and scriptwriter who writes for children as well as adults. She knows a lot about the octopus and their sex habits, among other things. She is the author of more than 20 books, excuse me, including The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness, which was a finalist for the 2015 National Book Award for Nonfiction and a New York Times bestseller. And I really encourage everybody to go to cymontgomery.com, and it's S-Y in case you have any doubts, and really spend a little time enriching your life, learning about this amazing, courageous explorer who does things that I don't even dream about. And she does immersion journalism a lot. So, Cy, in the very brief time we have left, and, you know, I always have to comment, people sometimes say, well, isn't an hour interview too long? And I think, not with the guests I get. It's never long enough. It's never long enough.
Oh, my gosh, you get fabulous guests.
It's just, it's so fun. But one of the things I'd like to talk about is going back to climate change, because for this interview, it is, and every interview, I want to include some conversation about it. It's the biggest threat to life on Earth as we know it, global warming, whatever you want to call it. Is it fair to ask, I mean, is the octopus being threatened in imminent danger for extinction now because of the oceans and ocean acidification? What kind of shape are they in? Before I go into my next heavy question.
We don't really know, because there are 250 different species of octopus, some of which were just discovered last year. They are very hard to study because, A, they're difficult to find, and you can't count them, because is the one over there who's green the same one you saw over there who's red?
Makes
I mean,
so
it could be
sense.
The same octopus. They can change color and shape. So we do not know. But what we do know is that the ocean itself is changing even more rapidly than the rest of the globe because of climate change, and that reefs are dying at unprecedented rates. And
it's unreal when you look at pictures. They're just dead.
Oh, it's hideous.
Dead.
It's hideous.
Yeah.
That we would spit in the face of our mother like this. And what kills me, too, is that even if climate change were not affecting you directly as you sit in your house, the pollution that is causing the climate change is. I mean, climate change is caused by pollution, which is deadly to humans. No one disputes that.
No one disputes it. And it's just like, you just have to care and know that we're all connected. It just, to me, it's the antithesis of a political debate. It's the
That's
reality
right.
of science. That's all. It has nothing
right.
to do with how I voted. It is. That's what I'm saying to people. It is.
That's right. That's right. And if you're talking about, you know, if if you like science, if you like facts, let's look at the facts. Let's listen to the scientists.
Yes.
If you want to put, you know, I mean, this whole thing about alternative facts are called lies. So let's not obscure the facts. Let's look at the facts.
Oh,
and, you know, it doesn't...
I'm so glad you wove that in. What are alternative facts? Yeah.
I cannot believe that our president's press secretary, when confronted with you put out this false information, and then she said, well, you know, they were alternative facts. But it's either raining or it's not.
That was a Lulu, as my mother would have said. Well, that was a real Lulu.
I know, and, you know, there either were X number of people or not. You can count these things. It's measurable. So let's tell the truth to the American people. We can trust the American people. You know,
I
think once we have the real facts, you know, once we have demonstrable facts that scientists have discovered, if we put these out in front of thinking, feeling people, they're going to make the right decisions. And that's why I'm a writer, because I trust our fellow Americans.
Yes, yes. And it's a perfect segue to the question I have about the books that you write, specifically in this case, children's books, and the book about Temple Grandin, which was illuminating and very powerful. So do you believe, and of course I know the answer to this, not just do they help raise the consciousness among the kids reading your books and your fans, as it were, but do you think it helps through connect them more with nature so that the conversation about global warming and climate change becomes important to them at some level? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I certainly believe and hope that. With Nick Bishop, a wonderful photographer, I founded a series of books for Houghton Mifflin called Scientists in the Field. And these, you know, all of our scientists are heroes and heroines. They are models, different kinds of models for kids. The very first one we did, that was the one for the research. I got to sit in a pit with 18,000 snakes. And they were harmless, lovely little garter snakes. I was thrilled to be with them. I would have rather been in the pit with 18,000 snakes than a cocktail party any day. But anyway, and everybody said, oh my gosh, you're insane. Kids aren't going to like this. Well, kids love animals.
They do, and they're not afraid.
They're not afraid, and they are very powerful educators of we adults. And to highlight the scientists who are doing work on the natural world also shows kids, like, you know, Bob Mason, the guy who was studying these snakes in the largest snake pit in the world, which, by the way, is in Manitoba, Canada. Bob Mason, he wasn't always the world's greatest student. Some of the scientists that I highlight were, some didn't understand what science was. One, the tarantula scientist I later wrote about, thought that science was a big book of facts that you just had to memorize. It wasn't all about finding new cool stuff out.
Right.
One woman I wrote about, Lisa Daybeck, who studies tree kangaroos in the cloud forests of Papua New Guinea, she had such bad asthma growing up, she couldn't even have a pet. And now she hikes up 10,000 feet into the cloud forest to study these animals.
Kangaroos what did you say? Seriously, I was
kangaroos.
Listening.
Tree. Yes. There's quite a few species of kangaroos who live in the trees.
It's just giving me really
exciting.
Great content for the Cy Montgomery series coming soon. But it has to be on TV because a lot of this has to go on TV. So, yes.
Well, they better get someone who's better looking than I am. I have the perfect face for radio.
That is not true. I saw your picture, so stop it. There's no negativity on Mrs. Green's World.
Boy, no, I like Mrs. Green's World. This is a world I want to be in.
It's a world I want to be in, too. Let's not go to the end of the show without you talking a little bit about Christopher Hogwood. It's such an amazing story, and I'm sure it's so part of your life and everything. I mean, it's just, I'm going to order the book. I'm going to try to go to my used bookstore, which has lots. Bookman's is here in Tucson, and they have 7 places, but I'll try to get it so that we're reusing. But talk to us about The Good, Good Pig.
Well, Christopher
Hogwood. Like, unreal.
He was just a great big Buddha master. He came home as a sick, runty pig who fit in a shoebox on my lap and grew to 750 pounds and a huge constituency, including people overseas who knew about him. He used to get write-in votes at most elections in our little town.
And of course he did.
He provided an anchor for my life. He provided for me a way to connect with children, which before I hadn't been that well connected with. He gave me just a great appreciation for the things that really matter in life, including chocolate donuts, but also...
which really matter.
the feeling of loving little hands patting you in the sun, and the joy of just lying under an apple tree under a fall, you know, a fall canopy. He knew what really was joyful about life and taught me how to love what the world gave me, even if it was slops.
Right, right. I mean, seriously, it's just... This is not just a book for children, clearly.
It's an adult book, actually. It's not a children's book at all.
I have to get it. I mean, I really have to get it.
And it's a book about family. And, you know, family is not just you and your, opposite sex, same race, same species partner, and your genetically produced children. You know, family can be multi-species. Family is made out of love, not genes. And we started this program talking about my family. I'm very proud of my mother and father, but we also had our problems, and they disowned me.
You're
for
kidding.
The person I married. And although I was with both of them when they died, and I know that they loved me, at the time that they were rejecting their only child, I was accepted by someone who was a different species. I was accepted and loved by a pig.
Right, right.
And by lots of other animals. And discovered that I could build a family out of love. And if I can do it, anyone else can do it too.
And the connection with animals. I mean, the research about people's, you know, I call it their environmental IQ, is so strongly in favor of connect kid with nature and the world will right itself. I mean, it's almost that simple, because if you are in nature and you experience nature and you have any kind of connection with all of her bounty, you will want to protect Mother Earth. And some of the expressions you used, I mean, it's an assault. It's a full-on assault right now.
It's really bad. But, you know...
That's what we're here for.
We have a chance to be great.
Yes, we do. And there has to be, I tell myself when I go to the dark side... There has to be a lot of good that will come out of this, and people rise up. I mean, it's my show is becoming much more about let's have the conversation about climate change and global warming in every show. And what do you think your impact is on affecting change in that arena? Because our lives depend on it, so it's very easy. I have to ask you a couple of other things too, because if not, I'll have to call you back and we'll talk for an hour. But it's like, what is there? Are there one or two examples that were just so outrageous and scary that you want to share with us? Because it is an incredible life that you've lived, and you have had experiences that movies are made of. So what comes to mind when I say, Sai, when were you terrified? Or when did you laugh the hardest? Or what creature did you fall in love with the most? There's 16 questions, so you better hurry.
Well, I've never been really frightened by an animal.
Ever?
But I have been frightened by people. My memories of animals have just been fantastic. I guess I'll share one with the pink dolphins in the Amazon, since you have met those animals.
You never forget.
I went on four different expeditions trying to learn about these animals who... The local people believe are enchanted. They believe they can turn into people and that they will come and appear at dances as the most beautiful woman or the handsomest man or the best musician, and you'll fall in love And then in the morning, you'll wake up and the gift that they gave you, maybe it was a beautiful watch or a nice necklace, has turned into a little pile of silvery fish and your lover is gone.
Wow.
So I fell hard for these beautiful pink dolphins that live in the Amazon. And on my last expedition, my fourth expedition, I found a place that was largely deserted and I could swim out a quarter mile into the river and seven dolphins would come and swim with me. And this was not a swim with dolphins program at all.
Right.
I mean, there was nobody there except for the boatman who I had hired and my photographer, Diane Taylor Snow, who was standing on the deck of the boat trying to get pictures of this. And I never touched the dolphins, but they came very close to me. And instead of touching me, what they did was they would swim beneath me and release an effusion of bubbles, which would sizzle up my skin. And it was like a caress. Well, when I went home, I found that they do this in captivity. There was only one place at that time that had had pink dolphins in captivity for any length of time, multiple dolphins, and that was the Duisburg Zoo in Germany. And they had observed their dolphins doing that, and they believed they did it to each other almost as a kind of massage.
Oh, my gosh. And they're just so amazing and magical and gorgeous. Now, that is one thing that you did that I would have had the guts to go with you because that's beautiful and not scary to me.
Well, it was worse anything. I mean, I've got to say, though, these dolphins, people would say always to me, "Cuidado como boto," you know, be careful of the boto. And I thought they were saying, be careful it doesn't enchant you and take you away to the enchanted encantado beneath the you know, the encant beneath the water. But I asked one of the fishermen who said this, oh, is this because your fray will be taken away? And he said, no, they bite.
You're kidding.
Yeah, they do bite. But they didn't bite me.
That's clearly they were caressing you. And you know, I'm on this board for SATO, which is an international board, and our focus is on the Sea of Cortez, which of course has the vaquita, which
yes.
are just
oh my gosh.
Yes. And we
You know
are,
who you have to get on is Brooke Besessen, who has just been down there investigating the situation with the vaquitas.
And so what is her name?
I'll put you in touch.
Okay, good, good. Let's do that. Now, we have, you know, maybe less than 4 minutes, which is, I always think maybe we're in a time warp when I'm on these kind of, it's really not an interview. It's such a conversation and illuminating my life and feeding me to go on with this journey of spreading the word about people like you. What do you want to say in the last couple of minutes in terms of the takeaway to our audience, the call to action based on your vast life experiences? What would you like them to be left with other than octopuses having sex? Which is not bad.
Well, I would say, and this is a quote from Thales of Miletus, the universe is alive and has fire in it and is full of gods. And what that means to me, what that quote means to me, is that our world is far more animate and cognizant and holy and sacred than we could possibly imagine. And it is the highest and best use of our lives to praise and protect it.
It's probably the most powerful close that I've ever had. And I don't get emotional on the air very much because then people say, you know, how can she be such a good interviewer? And to me, more people should show emotion, but I don't want to say anything else. I want to leave everybody with that thought. I want to encourage people to Google Cy Montgomery, to look at her books, to buy some of her books, and to become a part of her magnificent world. And Cy Montgomery, I mean, my life is better because you are in it. And I feel our paths will cross again. And
I feel
very grateful. Next week, folks, we have two great shows again. February 14th, we're going to be talking with a guy named Mike Urquhart. I have to get the pronunciation. Urquhart, who's an exercise physiologist at Tucson Medical Center to discuss heart health, the number two killer in our country. and our Mrs. Green's World show, James Nestor, Making Contact. You ready? New approaches to cracking the communications of dolphins and whales. I'm on a roll. Cy wow. Montgomery, bless you and thank you.
Thank
Make
you,
it a great
Gina.
Green day, everybody.